For a professional baseball team to be successful, the manager must certainly orchestrate the strategy of each game. But there's another aspect to managing in baseball that is equally, if not more, important. This has to do with managing the players themselves to get the most out of their ability. Here's Rich Walkoff, sports director of KGO Radio San Francisco, with one of the best players managers in baseball today.
He's been around baseball quite a long time. He was in the on-deck circle for the Atlanta Braves in April of 1974 when the amazing Hank Aaron hit home run number 715 to break the legendary Babe Ruth's all-time record. He played 16 full seasons for the Braves and three other teams, the Dodgers, the Giants, and the Oakland A's, earning All-Star honors in 1981 and 1982. He managed the Giants to a World Series, the Cubs to the playoffs, and is currently the manager of the Cincinnati Reds, and he has been named Manager of the Year several times. He is one of Major League Baseball's ambassadors of goodwill and has earned the reputation of being a true player's manager. Here to talk with us about what it means to be a player's manager is Dusty Baker. Well, Dusty, thanks so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, Rich.
It's all good. Now, first of all, what does it mean when we hear that catchphrase, "You're a player's manager"?
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, Rich, I really don't know. And the reason I don't know is because nobody's ever told me what the opposite of a player's manager is. I mean, you know, if there's an east, there's a west, if there's a north, there's a south. But if I just think there's one kind of manager, you know, and what is the other so-called opposite of a player's manager called? And to me, a manager's job is to be, you know, with his players, to discipline his players, to protect his players and to get his players together, you know, as a unit. So if that's a player's manager, I guess that's it. But, you know, something I remember what it was like to play. I remember the game wasn't as easy as these guys make it look. And, you know, I try to, if I'm critical with the guys, I try to do it privately and not publicly.
Yeah, well, I guess if we could say, some might think a manager may be the company or the owner's right-hand man, as opposed to a guy who feels what the players feel and relates better to the players than the corporate side of things.
Well, you know, the thing about it is, I mean, you know, a baseball manager, I don't know what it's like in other sports, but we are the epitome of middle management, where we're employed, we're paid by, you know, upper management, but I'm also in the players' union as far as my pension, my medical, my dental, you know, all my benefits. So I'm definitely a man, you know, in the middle. And so, you know, I'm under the sanctions of and the rules of Major League Baseball. So, you know, the main thing is I just try to do my job, try to be myself, try to be firm but fair, honest as I possibly can without lying to guys. There are certain things you can't tell them, you know, certain things that are privileged for management. So it's a very, very uncompromising in a difficult situation sometime, but you know, you have to find a way to satisfy both sides and get the job done.
Yeah, it's a delicate balance because, as you say, you have one foot in the owner's circle as a management guy, yet your roots are that of a player, and you're trying to get the best out of 25 guys every game.
And you're trying to get their respect. I mean, that's what's the hardest thing to get is their respect and to get their trust. I mean, that's the hardest thing, you know, that I have found that, you know, that a player, you know, that a manager has to get. Well, especially in modern times. You know, in modern times, you know, there's a basic distrust, I think, for authority, you know, and I don't know if that goes back to the homes now or goes back to, you know, fathers, mothers, teachers, ministers, all kind of people are, you know, have contributed probably to this basic distrust, you know, of young people of authority. So the main thing you got to do, you got to get their, their trust, let them know that, hey, man, I got your back, but yet still you owe us something, too, because you are employed by the same people I'm employed by.
How ironic is this, Dusty? You and I came out of the 60s and the 70s when question authority was the mantra of the time, and now you're the establishment guy. So the more things change, the more they stay the same, huh?
Well, I guess so. But, you know, back in our time, though, I don't know if it was question authority as much as it was just being a basic nonconformist for the sake of being a nonconformist. And, you know, but again, I was in the middle then, too, because I was hanging out at Haight-Ashbury and Winterland and Fillmore and Golden Gate Park. But then the next year I was in the, you know, Marine Reserves, you know, in a riot control unit that I really, didn't want to be at that time. But it ended up being one of the best things for me because I did need some discipline. I needed some direction. So, like I said, I've been in the middle or on one side or the other, you know, most of my life.
Well, that's not the middle. I think you cover the whole thing. I mean, you do it from all sides, which is rather unique. Not many people were hanging out with the lefties and also wore a Marine uniform.
Well, you know, the hard part about the whole thing is that, you know, the afros are in. And, you know, going to reserve meetings once a month, you couldn't, you know, how much can my hair grow in a month? You know what I mean? And so every month I had to get a haircut. I was like, man, my afro is just starting to look good here. But like I said, it taught me a lot, you know, and it taught me to get along with people on all sides, you know, and no matter, you know, where you're from or whatever. And that's the, you know, that was the beauty of my past.
Yeah, and of course it's something you carry with you today, and your ability to read people, size them up, and get a sense of where they're at. Now, how does that play into your managing of younger players and veterans who could be as different as night and day?
Well, I mean, again, like I said, you know, from my background, coming from Southern California and mostly Hispanic and a black culture to Northern California, where I was only a black guy in high school, me and my brother, to going straight to the South, you know, 2 years after that, to go, you know, to the Marines, and I went to winter ball, where I was one of the few guys that spoke Spanish. So I'm kind of well-rounded on being in different environments and being around different people and trying to bring people, you know, together. Being the oldest of five in my family, you know, I've always had a sense of responsibility, not because I wanted it, because it was forced upon me, because I was the oldest by my parents. And so, you know, with all these things, and, you know, being an older father, I think is really helping me a lot. You know, my daughter, she's 28 now, and so she used to keep me up on what was happening, you know, before and now. Or she'll say, hey, Dad, you know, your pants are too tight. And I was like, hey, girl, what are you talking about? Or, Dad, bring those white socks down. My socks are way up by my, you know, by my knees someplace. And also, I got a son that'll be 9 years old this week, and so, You know, they keep you young, they keep you up on what's happening today, and you know how to deal with the young people and young generation. I mean, and quite frankly, I've rarely had a problem dealing with young people, or dealing with, you know, elderly people who I have the utmost respect. I mean, most of the problems I've ever had are basically people, you know, my age that want me to act like them or act like they think I should at this age.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so you sound like the man for all seasons, the man for all generations, but does that come into play when you're either disciplining or encouraging a younger player versus a veteran player in any way, shape, or form?
Well, you know, you try to treat them the same, but basically it's impossible to treat everybody the same, because everybody doesn't take discipline the same way. You know, like, you have basic rules for everybody on your team. But you try to find out as much as you can about guys, which ones will go in a shell, which ones do you have to punish verbally, which ones do you have to threaten physically even sometimes, you know, which you try not to get to that point, which ones you can raise your voice to, which ones, will completely just, you know, go into a shell. That's why you try to find out as much about their background and their social structure and the importance in their own family and social structure to, you know, to try to determine some sense of you know, where they're coming from or why they are what they are, you know, without prying too deep, you know, into their family.
Yeah, I guess 25 guys and 25 different relationships as you have. Your old friend and longtime manager, Tony La Russa, was saying to us that not only do you have to deal with each individual individually, if you will, but sometimes it's a carrot and a stick at the same time, you know,
right,
a kick
is.
In the behind and a little encouragement at the same time.
And it could be 25 different guys in 25 different places. I mean, a young man probably from Oklahoma might have a different set of values than a young man from Beverly Hills, and then a young man from South Central L.A. is going to have a different sense of values than possibly somebody from, you know, New York or Connecticut. So, you know, I think it's really helped me a lot to have been in a lot different environments. You know, all my friends, they say, hey, man, you can go anywhere and any place from, you know, country western to, you know, to soul food restaurant down, you know, down in the hood. Doesn't matter to me. I can go get a haircut over here, or I can go over there, and I feel safe and comfortable and relax anywhere I go. That's why I'm trying to raise my son at the same time and not being afraid, embarrassed, or intimidated, you know, by any environment in our country or abroad as well.
Yeah, well, your background, it speaks volumes for your worldliness and why you've been so successful in these challenging times with managing young athletes who may feel the sense of entitlement or privileged, or, you know, I've got the money, I've made it, I don't need to take advice or orders from anybody and, you know, get out of my face kind of mentality. But given all the issues regarding race and ethnicity in America, are there any differences between ethnic and racial groups as to how you work with them as a so-called player's manager?
Well, I mean, there's definitely a difference. Like I was saying earlier, you know, I mean, a young kid from here, you know, might not, you know, have the same values or morals or either outlook on life as a kid from on the other side. How can he? And, you know, not only do they have to deal with that, I mean, you get a minority kid from affluency, you have to talk to him and treat him a little different than a, you know, normal kid that came up the hard way. And so, like I said, you try to deal with them as a group to bring them together as a group. And I think being in the Marines helped me a lot, you know, because they made me the guide on, which is the leader of the platoon, and I had total responsibility. And I'm telling you, we had guys in there from doctors and lawyers to guys that couldn't say their ABCs, or guys that were illiterate, guys that were from coal mines, guys that were from the Bronx, and you got to find a way to get together and, you know, with a common goal and a common cause, even if you don't like each other, because the thing about it, you're together for X amount of time, which is most of the time, you're with each other more than you're with your family, whether it's on the plane, whether it's on the bus, it's in the clubhouse. I mean, for a good 7 to 8 months, you are with each other every day, almost all day. You get maybe 1 or 2 days off a month break from each other. So you got to find a way to, you know, coexist in the workplace and get along, you know, with a common goal. And hopefully, like I say, hopefully, you know, we can get a different outlook on each other and all be brothers. And what I try to do a lot of times is try to have guys bring in, you know, their favorite food. I mean, Venezuelans eat different than Puerto Ricans. Puerto Ricans eat different food than guys in the South. Guys in the South eat different than guys in the Northeast or Northwest. And so you bring in different foods, and that way you break down a lot of the stereotypes about different people, because there are people who don't like Mexican people, supposedly, but they eat a taco every day. Or there's people that don't like Jewish people, they go eat some lox and bagels. Or people might not like black people, but they like, you know, collard greens and cornbread. I mean, not to stereotype, but, I mean, basically, let's try each other's foods and let's hang out a little bit with each other and find out that really there are no differences between each and every one of us.
Hey, that's really well said. And it's sort of that universality of all peoples, that they have more in common than not. But just because we do things differently doesn't make us different as people. And maybe as a manager, you're kind of the UN ambassador, because you got to bring all these disparate cultures and ethnicities together. But again, more commonality than anything.
Well, especially now, it's even more prevalent now, because you have you know, everybody coming from all over the world now, where before it was parts of the world and mostly the United States, but now it's from all over the world. And so it's even more important, you know, to bring people together when they're from so many parts of the world. I mean, it must be, I remember how difficult it was on a number of the Latin American players to come here to try to order food, to try to, you know, speak the language and adjust. So imagine how hard it must be for, you know, a kid from, you know, South Korea, or another kid from, you know, from Japan, or now we're going to China. I mean, there's places that we're going to go to, you know, Africa. There's places that we're going to go to acquire players from all over the world, which is evident of the World Games. I thought that was one of the greatest things that they could have ever thought of. Now baseball has definitely turned into a world game.
Yeah. Now, how about the perception among your players and the kind of manager that you are, the goods and the bads of that, if you will?
I really can't worry about that too much. I can just be myself and do the best job that I can do on a daily basis and try to be firm but fair and try not to draw any lines and try not to. I mean, I'm not perfect by any means, but, you know, you're always striving, you know, for perfection of yourself and your players and try to get better. I was watching something this morning that I thought was like, you know, a guy I really didn't understand, but the more I watch and the more I see things, you know, the more I'm tending to understand him. And I'm similar in ways where they're talking about he's complex, but he's also simple. He's probably borderline arrogant, but he's also very humble at the same time, which is Bobby Knight retiring. And, you know, I found that very, very interesting. And he came to see me when I was doing the Little League World Series. And there's a lot to learn, you know, as to why, you know, a person responds one way or the other. And there's a lot to learn when I'm watching Coughlin talk about John Wooden, and I have his books. He signed a couple to me. I'm like, man, I got to go back and do some more studying, because sometimes you have all these resources at your disposal, but then you tend to sort of forget about them or figure, hey, I know. And so this has really been good for me to be off, to recreate myself, to think about things that Bill Walsh told me over the years, and Al Attles and all the great mentors that I've had along the way.
Yeah, those are the prophets you're talking about who have achieved so much, like yourself. And one final question, speaking of prophets, Jackie Robinson once said, a life is only significant as it impacts others.
Correct.
And you've brought out the best in so many by being that player's manager, and have had a significant impact on so many lives. Is it meaningful and fulfilling to you personally to be known as a player's manager in all that you've done in the game?
Well, not really. I don't look at it as if I've done a lot in the game. I look at it as if I got a whole bunch to do. And that's strange that you mentioned that about Jackie Robinson, because I'm looking at that and Jackie Robinson right now in my office, in my home, who's one of my heroes, one of my dad's heroes. So I remember talking to Sadahata O, and he said years ago, and I asked him, when is he ever satisfied? Because he had like 9 or 10 MVPs, and he says, you're never satisfied until you give all you have, and until you retire, and then you look back and think about some of the things that you've done. And so right now I'm trying not to look backwards to see what I've done. I'm trying to look forward to see, what I will do.
Yeah, because someone may be gaining on you, right?
Well, I got that over here too. I got Satchel Paige. All these guys you keep mentioning, all the guys I have on the walls in my house.
Well, there must be hallowed hallways then, my man. Hey, Dusty, thanks so much. Dusty Baker, manager of the Cincinnati Reds. Appreciate your time.
All right, thank you.
We've just heard how important it is for a baseball manager to know and work with the character of his players so they can perform at their very best. Now, Joel, how does this concept relate to the Arete School?
Well, Martin, good question. And this is really at the heart of respecting the learning abilities of every child. Some kids learn one way, some kids learn another, some learn faster, some learn slower. So just as Dusty Baker had to treat each athlete, each ball player differently based on the character of that athlete, same thing at the Arete School. We're going to respect the learning abilities of every child, and we're not going to have a standardized curriculum, cookie cutter, one size fits all, that the kid has to go at the rate that the teacher teaches. We're going to go at the rate at which the child learns, and we respect the learning abilities of every child. And in that context, that's where self-paced, mastery-based learning comes from. You go at the pace at which the child learns, and you make sure, though, that they master every assignment before they go on to the next one. And this is so important to the motivation of every child, because if the child who learns slower is overwhelmed, then they're going to withdraw.
Back away.
Exactly. Yeah. And if the child who can learn much faster is held back, they get bored.
They get bored.
And
not
they
engaged.
Back. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So that's why, just like Dusty Baker had to deal with the differences in his ball players, we're going to deal with that with the students at the Arete School. And in fact, at the Arete School, we're going to have what are called, we don't call our teachers teachers, we call them coaches. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to have master coaches, which means that each teacher, each coach, is responsible for his or her 25 students to make sure that the learning that they're experiencing is self-paced and that the student is mastering all the assignments. And if there's a problem anywhere, that master coach is responsible for figuring out what the issues are so that they're resolved so that child can be successful. Mm-hmm. And so we're hoping that people will appreciate this kind of learning and want to see it not only at the Arete School,
right,
but in public schools around the country. But we first have to show how this works by creating the Arete School. So we hope people will click donate below the screen here, and that'll send them to the American Sports Institute website where they can see how they can support the Arete School with a donation.